So I call this talk Going Beyond, and it does address my experience of going to the place where the Buddha died, but I decided I would spend a little bit more time on the actual text that accounts or recounts the Buddha's last days. And I'm going to read it. I'm most unusual for me. I don't usually read talks. So it's quite a challenge to find the right words to talk about this event in the Buddha's calendar. It's even harder to create advertising to encourage people to attend. What can you say about the truth of Parivana Day to those who've never attended one? To be honest, the other events, festivals and celebration days are a little easier to talk about. So Buddha Day, or Wesak, is a time of celebration, a time to rejoice in the Buddha's enlightenment. It's because he sat beneath the ficus religiosa, or the Bodhi tree, and saw the true nature of all phenomena, which is no nature. And he chose to act out of compassion, to share the way to this truth with others, that we are all here today. What he rediscovered there has been passed down to us and affected the lives of countless people, even us in this room. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. Buddha Day is indeed something to celebrate, to rejoice in. So the Buddha Day festival is one of our own potential and the potential of all people. Dharma Day is a powerful festival and one of my favourites. In it, we acknowledge that the Buddha communicated the essence of his teaching to others, in this case, five friends and colleagues in the spiritual life. Here he first shared the Four Noble Truths that spell out in practical, almost mundane terms how to become free from anguish, discomfort, and that existential sense of unsatisfactoriness that we meet in difficult moments. Here he asked his brothers in the spiritual life and us by association to reflect on our actions of body, speech, and mind, and actively shape our lives with mindfulness and a greater care for others. He laid out the basics that will take us to the goal, and that's something we need to be reminded of again and again. This festival, Dharma Day, is a festival of reaffirmation and clarification. Sangha Day is a time to join together and publicly acknowledge that we can't practice the spiritual life in a vacuum. We are in a community of practitioners with all the complexity that entails. We can call on all those around us who walk the path for support, for friendship and encouragement, even for inspiration. And in turn, we can be an inspiration to others. So it's a festival of positive friendship and exemplification. But Parinirvana Day is the day when the Buddha died. What can we celebrate about that? In the Christian tradition, the time of Easter, which was, by the way, originally a pagan festival called Ostara, in case you didn't know, is when Christ's death and resurrection is seen as a promise of forgiveness. But in the original reading of the Buddha's last days, one finds in the text grief, sorrow, loss, and conflict. Why should we celebrate this? Is the Parinirvana a celebration of death? Well, I hope that in this brief talk, we'll look at a few ways we can approach Parinirvana Day by highlighting some of the implicit rather than explicit teachings in the account of the Buddha's passing, so that instead of mire ourselves in misery, we can see this time as a celebration of life, the life of the Buddha, and the lives of those around us who have made a great contribution, and of our own precious life and the contribution that we make. So I'll be drawing on this huge discourse of the Buddha, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and I'll be referencing my experience of being on pilgrimage in India and standing on the spot where the Buddha died. So the events of the Buddha's last days are recorded in a lengthy sutta called the Mahaparinibbana, or Discourse on the Great Enlightenment Without Remainder, the Great Release, the Great Passing, the Great Unbinding, which is my personal favourite. I love that, the Great Unbinding. And it occurs in a collection of suttas called the Digha Nikaya. It's long and it serves a number of purposes. In terms of the Buddha's life story, it recounts him as an old man who exhibits all the difficulties of aging, but without the suffering that normally attends it. Though tired, he walks through the Indian landscape with his attendant and cousin, Ananda, encountering monks and laypeople. During this time, he offers teachings, many of which he's offered before. It seems that this is his last world tour. And it's whilst visiting one layperson that the Buddha eats something that unintentionally poisons him. And he contracts dysentery, which ultimately leads to his death in a small, unremarkable village called Kushinara. The text is rich in emotion, lamentation, supernatural splendour, poetry, and some rather crisp and pertinent exhortations to get off your butt and practice. We'll be hearing extracts from this beautiful text in the puja tonight. But for the purposes of this talk, I want to explore four really mundane episodes. They're not cosmic or unusual, but in them I think is something of great relevance to us. And the four moments are these. One, someone lived. Two, something shines. Three, someone cries. And four, somebody arrives. Someone lived. Whereas in later Buddhism, the Buddha became something similar to a god, eternal and open to prayer in some traditions. But the Buddha in the early scriptures is very, very human, very accessible. That's not to say that he does not have his fair share of miraculous activity or conversations with gods and spirits and other beings, but he presents to us as possessing a very human body that gets tired and needs to be cared for. It's a body that needs rest and, in the case of this sutta, has to have a special place prepared for it to rest and lie down, as we can see here with the figure on the shrine lying down in this rather regal reclining position. In the sutta, after he arrives in the dusty village, he enters into deep meditation, creating a calm and peaceful state of consciousness, and after a time, he dies. The system of his body breaks down. What happens to his consciousness after the physical death of the body is one of those great mysteries that he would not address. But the fact of the matter is that if his physical body, built up by various conditions, had not ended, that act in itself will have nullified his own teachings on impermanence and of conditioned co-production. If he had not been unbound, not passed on, as had others of his followers who had achieved enlightenment, then his presence would contradict essential Buddhist doctrines. All conditioned things, all perceived phenomena, even a physical form taken by a Buddha, are subject to old age and death. They arise in dependence upon conditions, and when these conditions cease, so too does that phenomena. As he says in the sutta, fabrications are inconstant. What else is there to expect? We need to bear this in mind. We too will require rest and preparedness as we age. We will need someone to be there for us to prepare a couch upon which we must lie at some point. We will age and decay. But let's look, before our inevitable death, at the quality of our lives and the impact we have had on the lives of others. Are we, like the Buddha, someone who lives their life in service to other people's growth? How have we benefited others? Will people be there for us when we tire and need to lie down, or have we alienated them all? Now, it's important here not to compare your own selfless deeds to those of the magnitude of the Buddha, but just look at your life and consider on how small or how large a scale you have brought joy and ease to people around you. Will you go into that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, as Hamlet says, with a sense that you did some good? Well, yes, you have. You must have. You really have. And others around you have too, including the people here whose photos we've placed on the shrine. Do you know someone in your life who is or was an inspiration? Someone who has perhaps left us, but whilst they were here, gave themselves for the benefit of others. This is their time too, not just the Buddha's time. Now you could choose to recognize and be grateful that these people have lived. And be grateful too that you are alive to remember them and their kindness. And remember that you can pass that kindness on to others, just like the Buddha's teachings have been passed to us. So that someone who lives is you. You live to carry on the teaching. Something shines. When asked what was to happen to his body after he died, the Buddha was initially dismissive, directing his followers to continue with their practice. But when further questioned, he gave instructions that included the creation of large memorials or stupas, like those that were used to mark the burial place of kings. These, he said, would brighten the mind of those who had conviction in the Buddha's teachings, faith in other words, and had feelings of urgency and dismay for the affairs of the world. Now he names the place of his birth, where he gained enlightenment, where he taught the Dharma, and the place of his final passing as being where such monuments should be and one might go for pilgrimage. In 209, a number of the men in Sydney went to India and engaged in the ancient practice of pilgrimage, though in a minibus, not on foot. With us came two young Bhutanese monks who joined us when they could not travel easily to the same places we wanted to go. And these two men became our friends. Each of the places we visited, many more than just the four that were listed before, had a unique atmosphere that was conducive to reflection and practice. This idea of brightening the mind was clear to me in a number of places. For something to be bright, it must have a light shine upon it. And in each of these places, a light was shone. But the sight of the Parinirvana is one of the most powerful experiences of kindness, devotion, and love I experienced on the pilgrimage. There's a photo just below the shrine that I took there, and I'll be referring to that in a moment. So perhaps during the puja, you might have a chance to look at it. When we arrived there, it was a fine day, warm with blue skies, at least in my memory. As usual in these places, we wore the blue shirt that you see me in now. Groups of young Indian men, overdressed in shabby chic, mixed with devotees in various coloured robes and saris as we approached the contemporary stupa that contained a statue of the Buddha in the same posture as we see here. And that's the stupa, the white stupa you see in the photograph. The statue inside left me unmoved, and the young Indian men were somewhat unsettling as they prowled about the site. However, sitting on the grass, watching one of our monk friends walk around the crumbling remains of the original stupa that was built on the site of the Buddha's death, I was deeply moved and I felt a connection to the thousands of years that people have been showing respect to the Buddha in this timeless way. At which point, I called my mother on my mobile phone, feeling a deep need to express my love to her and to acknowledge all that she had done for me throughout our troubled relationship. I was so grateful she was still alive and that I was able to express it. The phone call of 8 minutes cost over $100, thanks to data roaming charges, but it was worth it. So these days when I bow before a shrine, the way I judge to know if I'm fully present is if there is gratitude in my heart. Holy places don't have to be an airfare and several immunizations away. You can contact that gratitude right here, as if this was one of the four great holy places. Sitting here, reflecting on what the Buddha has offered you through your time here at the Sydney Buddha Center, even if this is your first time, and allowing gratitude to flow, is a pilgrimage of sorts that changes this experience and brightens the mind. So the something that shines can be you. Someone cries. Shortly before the Buddha dies, Ananda, his cousin and attendant, is moved by grief and takes himself away and he cries. It is beautifully described in the sutta. Ananda goes off to a nearby building and, quote, stood leaning against the door jamb, weeping. Here I am, still in training with work left to do, and the total unbinding of my teacher is about to occur, the teacher who has had such sympathy for me. I can almost see him distraught, sobbing against the doorframe. Perhaps he feels, and this is just intuiting, perhaps he feels that without the Buddha's presence, he will be unable to make any further progress and reach the shore of enlightenment. Don't you think that we're in Ananda's shoes right now? The Buddha is not a physical presence to inspire us daily. Sometimes we might even grow despondent and wonder why we bother, because we don't feel we've come far enough. We may feel distant from those who deeply inspire our practice. I know I feel this keenly at times when I think of my preceptor, Ratnaviewa, who isn't dead, but he does live in Auckland. Or of my father, who died 10 years ago this year and to whom I rarely listened. Sometimes I do despair. In the sutta, the Buddha is made aware of Ananda's tears and offers two essential teachings on how to deal with despair. After reminding him that all phenomena is insubstantial and impermanent, he reminds Ananda of what he has done, not of what he has yet to do. I'll say that again. He reminds Ananda of what he has done, not of what he has yet to do. To Ananda, he says, "You have waited on me, the Tathagata, with physical acts of goodwill, helpful, happy, wholehearted, without limit, with verbal acts of goodwill, with mental acts of goodwill, helpful, happy, wholehearted, without limit. You are one who has made merit. Commit yourself to exertion and soon you will be without mental fermentations. Soon you will be free." Like Ananda, we will make progress if we acknowledge what we have achieved, the kindness we've shown to ourselves and to others, and from there exert ourselves. It's in self-affirmation, self-metta, self-kindness, that we can lay the firm foundations of living a more selfless life. Then we can be the ones who cry, but cry with joy at what has already been achieved. Last point. Somebody arrives. Right, almost at the point of death, when the Buddha is surrounded by his closest living disciples and all manner of beings, he receives an unexpected visitor. Imagine the scene. The Buddha is laid out preparing to breathe his last, when along comes a stranger who wants to be taught something. Ananda is not at his best and he denies the man access, yet the Buddha is not so concerned about the cosmic drama that is about to occur, but rather that one man, one unknown man, one unfamiliar man might be set upon the path of freedom. And he says to Ananda, "Enough, Ananda, don't stand in his way. Let him see me, let him see the Tathagata. Whatever he asks me will all be for the sake of knowledge and not to be bothersome." So even at this intimate moment, this last minutes of life, the Buddha is concerned for others. Is it convenient to the Buddha and his followers? No. Does it show a lack of awareness on the stranger's part? Possibly, but his conviction was sincere, and it was that the Buddha recognized. I often think that I'm a part-time Buddhist who only acts Buddhisty when it's convenient for me. How willing am I to be there for others when it's not convenient, or when I would rather be doing something else? The example here of the Buddha's life suggests that nothing is more important than the earnest searching of others. We could strive to be more other-regarding and less self-cherishing. We may be the one arriving someday, or the one to greet the other on the doorstep. This moment could be so important. We could be the one who arrives, or the one who does the meeting. So in conclusion, the story of the Buddha's final days is filled with teachings. I recommend that you read it. You can get it online. But it is the example of his life, not of his death, that is what I've tried to draw focus to. The Buddha lived a life of service to others, for others. The impact of his kindnesses reached down through the ages, even to us right here. Also, we have known others in our lives who have, in their own small or large way, made a positive impact. And we, at our best and most skillful, impact positively on the lives of ourselves and others. To someone else, we are the kind face when they most need one. We provide the gentle words or the strong reminder. For other people, we are a Buddha to be. So at this time, we rejoice in the lives that have touched the world with insight and a loving heart. We express gratitude for their lives and we bow in acknowledgement of their strengths and their struggles, all those who have gone before. We bow in gratitude to whatever teachings we practice as they have come to us from the Buddha. And in so doing, in so bowing, our minds become bright and become a light for others to see more clearly. It is okay to cry. It is also okay to cry with joy at what we have done. It is fine to mourn, but don't dwell on what we have not yet done and make that a rod to punish ourselves with. Instead, see that in whatever or small or large way we have made progress. Don't rest on those laurels, but use that knowledge as a foundation for striving. And remember that all of this applies all of the time, not just when it is convenient or special. We can be kind at any time. We can be aware at any time. We can be grateful at any time. And we can look for truth right here, right now. With mindfulness, we can strive on and go beyond the limitations we impose on ourselves, others, and the world.